We hear someone say that he is fitted for a certain type of job. That means that his own peculiar pattern of internal processes makes it likely and suitable that he would fit into this particular type of vocation. He is always fitting into an external situation that corresponds with his internal interests. Interests are always the areas of growth and development. Indifferences are always undeveloped areas. When it became obvious that General Grant did not know at the time he was President of the United States whether the local band was playing Hail to the Chief or Yankee Doodle, it was assumed, and the general himself admitted, that he had little ear for music. It was one of his deficiencies. He had no interest in music, whatever. He didn't know a tune, he couldn't carry one. Now, this indifference does not necessarily mean that the general had outgrown music. It didn't mean, as some hold, I met a very impatient man one day, and he was really the impatient spiritual type. He was one of those persons who, according to his own estimation, was wonderfully poised but subject to righteous indignation. And I asked him how it was that he was so impatient and at the same time so very highly advanced. And he told me with a perfectly straight face that he had been patient for so long that he had outgrown the need for it. Now, you can't ask for anything which is a more marvelous picture of the peculiar chemistry of this man's personality. And everyone has these, shall we say, delightful little eccentric areas. But actually, the fact that we are deficient in something does not mean we do not need it. It simply means we've neglected it. And just as an individual with a bad set of teeth cannot honestly say that he has no need of them, we are always in need of any factor which is inadequate in our own natures. For it is only from a balanced, integrated life that we can arrive at balanced, integrated conclusions on any subject. So the weak spots are not things that we can neglect and forget about and say, oh, well, we really don't need them. We're getting by without them. We're getting by without them, but we're getting by with a limp. We're getting by lacking something that we should have to make life richer and more valuable. We are also getting by with blind spots in our own consciousness, which will in time prevent us from recognizing valuable decisions and thereby limiting our success and advancement in almost any field of activity. Out of this imbalanced situation, with some faculties rather strong and others getting by and some not getting by at all, we also engender or generate this power which we call the will. And the will is not simply a single energy. Here I differ from Spinoza and Locke in their definition. I don't think that the human will is just one thing. Actually, when Locke goes into the description of the will, he doesn't either. He cannot but assume that the will is made up of parts. For into the structure of the will must go energies which are in themselves partile, that is, that have an individual or separate nature of their own. The will, therefore, is again the chemical product of the mingling of a number of streams of plus and minus factors. Now, we can speak of wills in various ways. The individual whose will is to us obnoxious, we term merely stubborn. We say this individual never knows when he's wrong, is never willing to acknowledge an error, and is never willing to accept instruction from anyone. When we sum all this up, we also rather regretfully decide that he is probably the man most likely to succeed because of these various characteristics that he possesses. He will succeed in a way, but he will succeed in a way in which his life will fall to pieces more rapidly than he can put it together. He may achieve that $1 million or the $10 million or become president of the great corporation, but he will certainly end with ulcers, and he will certainly have a miserable personal life and will probably reach a state in life that was once reached by John D. Rockefeller Sr., in which he candidly admitted that he would give most of his fortune if he could eat a square meal. This situation arises from these pressured types of human nature, human development, individuals who simply lose the power to be people and often do not really realize any longer that they have lost that power, except they have a gnawing misery in themselves. They're not happy. They're sad, hurt, disappointed, disillusioned people who are friendless and who are lacking in the simple things which make life pleasant and enjoyable. But the will, being conditioned out of this more or less gallimaufry of parts, a sort of a stew or soup, as it was called by some of the medieval Arab thinkers, of what we are and what we are not, this will does then become a drive. Now, we think of the will as a blind drive. It is not actually a blind drive. It is a very highly calculated drive. The only thing is that we have difficulty in trying to discover who is whipping the horse. Something is forcing this drive. This drive sometimes seems to cut entirely out of our own control. We can no longer slow it down ourselves. The thing that is driving, of course, is this ego complex in ourselves, this subjective entity which is pushing and fulfilling its own inordinate pressures. The ego has taken over, and the only thing the ego can do is to, shall we say, try to succeed in this world, because this is the only world in which this ego exists. It cannot plan for a greater and nobler destiny because it cannot survive into a nobler destiny. That part of man which is destined for better things is much deeper and wiser than the ego. The ego is experienced only in things of this world. It is drawing its substances only from the experiences of this world. Its likes and dislikes are based upon reflexes set up from environment. It is completely limited to this particular condition. And because it is so limited and so conditioned, its intensities have to work out on this level, or else these intensities have to be sublimated. Will is a sort of an irresistible force that is constantly coming up against an immovable object. This immovable object is the mass feather bedding of life itself. The will, no matter how tremendous it may be, finally runs out, but the problem never runs out. The individual may will with everything he's got for 80 years, but the objectives will survive him. The individual may build an empire and rule over it, but as surely as he builds it, he will leave it. And the empire will go on, and he will not. So the will is, first of all, completely limited by the possibility of human achievement. And many strongly willful people have watched their own physical health crumble with age, watched their sensitivities and sensibilities dim with time, and have seen the empires which they gave everything to create pass to the very hands they did not want to have succeed them. So we have had to watch these kind of experiences also. But the will is blocked and frustrated in every direction. Man is not an unlimited personality dwelling in an eternal time sequence. He cannot build on and on in this world, piling empire upon empire, piling one level of achievement upon another. Instead of having such an unlimited span in which to force through his own purposes, man will, like Caesar, fall at the foot of the statue of Pompey with his best friend's dagger in his heart, will, like Napoleon, end on St. Helena, or like Hitler, end in a bunker in Berlin. All of this tremendous willfulness is blocked by the fact that there are always other wills, and that the massings of these other wills can always overwhelm our will. This thought should cause us to relax a little. It should point out that wise people do not attempt the impossible. And even if they should achieve what they consider to be their goal, they have achieved nothing, because the goal will have to pass from them to someone else anyway. If Castro achieves his ends in Cuba, a microbe so small we cannot see it can achieve its ends in Castro, nothing will go on. The will to do all these things will be ultimately dissipated and drowned in the common sea of will that will go on forever. So in Eastern philosophy, the question simply arises, what are we doing with all this strange and rather purposeless expenditure of vital resources? Is the will worth the price? Actually, is the will the secret of achievement? Do we really get somewhere by knocking our heads against stone walls until something gives, often our heads? Is it actually true that man was created for the purpose of fighting his way to the top with brass knuckles? It seems doubtful. When we observe those who have been willful in the extreme, we see examples we really would not like to emulate. So in the Eastern concepts of philosophy, and in Western mysticism and philosophy also, the whole subject of the will has been given a lot of thought. And it has finally been almost universally acknowledged that over-exercising the will is one of man's champion ways of wasting time, that actually nothing can be accomplished by this means. In the Oriental philosophy, something else is substituted for will. And in very many instances, it works admirably. Because, first of all, will is too toxic in its very activity. It is something that is so heavily conditioned that the individual really never knows when it is supporting him and when it is tearing him down. So instead of will as the secret of getting somewhere, the Eastern mind says there is an effortless effort that is far more productive, far less dangerous, and can bring into activity unsuspected resources of consciousness. In the first place, will obscures facts. Will covers everything with a frightful burst of energy, and the elements and realities of the situation are just neglected. But by this means of effortless effort, the individual changes his policy, and a good example of this method of changing is in the selection of an adequate vocal coach if you intend to take singing lessons. In the, shall we say, robusto style, the principal problem was to open your mouth and bellow. And nearly all, many of the older singers were quite content and happy if they could rattle the chandeliers in the back of the opera house. Then it was gradually discovered that this was the best way to ruin a voice that there was. These voices were damaged, and damaged terribly. Today we know that the best way to learn to vocalize is to reduce effort. That the principal problem that every singer has to get rid of is his own throat. If he could lose it, he would sing better. Get his mind off of the noise he is making. Relax. And allow the breath to move as it will. And if he controls the breath with a minimum of mental energy, he will produce a pure tone. Well, if he gets behind it and shoves with everything he has, he will develop only a badly pressured, badly trained voice. Same thing in life. The purpose of life, the economy of life, is to use a minimum amount of energy to attain a maximum result. We only have a certain amount of energy. It is not limitless. It is true that some are more richly endowed than others, but energy is a conditioned quantity. And the energy that we waste is gone. And most of the energy we use energizing will is wasted. Let's take another example of this problem. Let us say that a person wishes to achieve a certain end. To achieve this certain end does not require any vast push. The only reason why the individual seemingly has to over-push in order to achieve is because he is trying to push through his own static. There is a situation in himself, a failure of his own nature to respond, and he has to practically force his way through his own inertia and indifference. If, however, the full nature of the personality is in agreement on something, if the purposes necessary, proper, and desirable are clearly understood, then the achievement is one of the simplest, most direct, and effortless way of achieving that end. This requires no will whatever. Requiring something quite different from will, nothing aggressive, but a constantly increasing understanding of that which is necessary. The individual who knows what is necessary and has a normal nature will do that which he knows to be necessary without fanfare, excitement, or pressure. All through life, therefore, there is this struggle against this type of will, which is forever thrusting out and interfering with the free circulation of human energies. And this quiet, controlled method by means of which the person moves continuously, effortlessly toward those goals which are right and proper for him. He is non-competitive. He does not need to compete because he knows within himself that the one true method of achieving is to attain the degree of insight which is necessary to control the condition. Willpower is almost always associated with a measure of bluff. The individual is forcing a situation which he does not actually understand or control. Thus, in the philosophical system, the purpose has always been to reduce the intensity of will action. Reduce this sense of continual emergency under which we live. Get over this idea that we must be doing something, even if it is not important. Get over this concept that if we appear to be driving with everything we have, we must be going somewhere. Because the only place we can be sure to get by that means is an early grave. It is the importance of the quiet, coordinated, continuity of enlightened purpose. This is what actually wins and conserves almost all of our natural energy and resource. We can proceed on a minimum of energy expenditure and achieve a maximum of constructive result. So as we begin to relax this power of the will, we begin to have to try to find out how we can change the chemistry in our own personality by means of which this will is forever popping up. The fact that we are willful seems to confront us with a problem. We can't just say to an individual, "Don't be willful." We might as well say to him, "Don't worry." He's going to keep right on worrying because it's his nature to worry. Therefore, the only way you can change the human being is to sneak up on him in some insidious manner and alter the syndrome. You can't touch him head on. You can't tell him to change. But you can do what Confucius did. And Confucius was a very wise man in these matters. He said to his disciples, "When you see the great prince who is very arrogant, very proud, very self-secure, don't go up to this man and tell him that he's wrong. Don't tell him that he's a fool, because he will probably reward you by having your head chopped off. And you will be the fool for having taken such an attitude. Do not attempt head-on collision with willful people. Do not attempt a head-on collision with your own will, because it's going to be a losing fight. How are you going to brace yourself against yourself? Where are you going to put this fulcrum with which you expect to turn over your own disposition? You have no place. The only thing you can fight will with is itself. And this is a kind of shadow boxing that seldom gets anywhere." So Confucius said, you can do this thing, but you must do it in an entirely different way. Wherever there is tremendous will intensity, there is also an area of intense guardianship. The individual who has his mind set on something, who is determined to accomplish something, and who is extremely willful, is ever upon the defensive against anyone who is apt to interfere with him. And he is also on the defensive against interfering with himself, for he would consider any mitigation of his own intensity by himself as only a symbol of weakness. He is going to be very hard to work with. So Confucius said, "When you see the great willful prince who is going to do exactly as he pleases, don't tell him about it at all. Teach him music. Leave his will the way it is. But add something somewhere to the pattern of his consciousness. And immediately the total syndrome will change." It has to. The individual who changes any part of his nature changes all of it. Don't go after his vital defense areas. Take on some other phase of his nature. If he is quarrelsome, teach him to paint. If he is an individual who has tremendous mental and emotional intensities, teach him the tea ceremony as they do in Japan. Take him out and let him become aware of another kind of world. Gradually induce him in some way to make some change of some kind in himself. Perhaps he can be induced to take up a hobby. Perhaps he can be convinced that some philanthropy or charity needs his managing ability. Perhaps he can be flattered or in some way or other impressed with the need for travel. Don't touch the vulnerable area in yourself or anyone else. because you will bring against yourself the whole total pressure of your own will. You have to get behind the will, realizing that as you become civilized, the will become less intensive. Thus, the total integration of your personality is the only way to ultimately subjugate the will. The will not press unless you have pressure. And people who are happy, adjusted, busy, well concerned with things that interest them, enjoying a diversity of life experience, having fun with their children, appreciating nice things, these people are not under this intense pressure, which can only be satisfied by an aggravated form of ambition. So whatever it may be, do not touch the delicate spot. Because instantly, like the sea anemone, the will close around and force the continuance of its own state. Rather, see how you can build into your own nature some other quality or attribute. Now, in the areas where this is most necessary, it is least seldom found. People who are interested in philosophy feel that life just has to be one great big philosophic tussle. They've got to think of nothing that is not deadly serious. They have got to have nothing on their mind but the vast need of humanity for enlightenment. And they have to continue to feel that they are the frustrated persons who might have been able to do great things if anybody had been willing to listen to them. It gets more and more tiresome. It gets more and more difficult. And there is no break in this strange determination of the nature to try to force good counsel on someone who doesn't want it. This is one of the great sources of human disappointment. The same in religion. Everyone takes religion so desperately seriously that they feel that more or less they are born to suffer. And therefore, if they develop in religious intensities of one kind or another, which alienate them from other people and make them difficult to live with, even for themselves, that there is some strange virtue in this, that they are really now beginning to suffer for the glory of God. This is not the type of mind that is going to solve anything. The true type of solution is the individual who is able to free himself from this tremendous sense of urgency, realizing that it is far more important to do things well than it is to do them quickly. So if possible, begin to balance into yourself elements by which you broaden and deepen appreciation of fineness, enlarge your interest in various areas which are now neglected, and if you are in some strongly professional pursuit that is humdrum and routine, try to make your avocational life, the parts of your day that are not dedicated to these necessary labors, make them as colorful and interesting and dynamic as possible. The individual who works all day and then goes home and sulks all evening is simply destroying himself. He must break away from this pressure of urgencies, or else he will ultimately be replaced by another man. Industry day is wearing out men in 5 and 10 years. The individual, under the pressures of the moment, is unable to meet this tremendous drive of industry. He wears himself out. And yet a Taoist monk could meet that drive for 50 years and be undamaged. He would get the work done, too, but there'd be no tension in himself, no stress, no strain, no fear. And because he was quietly, continuously fulfilling certain routine duties, the larger part of his mind would be free for his own thinking. He would never obstruct or obscure the whole mind with worries and anxieties over a small particular fragment of his intellect. So if the individual can gradually enlarge interests in a reasonable and sensible manner, he will find that he can gain a great deal of vitality and energy from this type of procedure. The opposite of this driving will is gracious adjustment. The individual who can adjust can survive. And a certain quiet graciousness gives us the remedy against this constant pressure of our own desire. Now, in Buddhism, of course, the emphasis is to get rid of the desire itself, to enter finally into a state of desirelessness until there is only really one desire left, and that is the desire to serve others. This desire, perhaps, is not as dangerous as some, but even this in Zen must ultimately be rejected. But in the common way of things, the reduction, the gradual, systematic reduction of desire has no effect upon efficiency. In fact, if anything, it improves it. Because the individual who is tense always takes longer to do anything. The nervous, pressureful, uncertain, fearing person is all thumbs. His work will be loaded with mistakes, and in his desperate effort to be always right, he will be frequently wrong. If this same person reduces these pressures within himself, he will achieve much more. I know one example. A person came to me who was really in a bit of a dither about the whole problem. He had that kind of an ego within himself that simply couldn't bear being wrong. Of course, he was wrong all the time, but he didn't find it out. But whenever it seemed that he was about to discover it, every resource of his nature tried to conceal the fact from himself. It was not that he was really so tremendously, sincerely dedicated to his profession. It was nothing but ego. He could not stand being wrong. And because he was always afraid that he would make mistakes, he made them by the dozen. Every moment, trying to protect his own infallibility, he made errors that were humiliating and very nearly cost him employment. If this man was able to simply stop the ego factor, he was well equipped to do his work. It wasn't that he did not know how. He was simply psychologically muscle-bound. Whenever a problem arose, tension came with it. Tension and fear. And his fear was simply the fear of humiliation. It never occurred to him that he would make mistakes and should be the first to admit that he made mistakes. After considerable working with this chap, I was finally able to get him to the point where he conceived that it was possible that he could, on rare occasions, make a mistake. This was the understatement of the generation, but at the same time, he finally got that far. And almost immediately, even this little break in his armament began to produce better results. And when he saw this, he did go on a little further. And after a while, he came to me and he said, "I've made a single victory. I've just made a mistake and laughed at myself. I've just said to myself, you see now just what a fool you can be." And he says, "I think I'm cured." And his rate of error went down immediately. As soon as he admitted it, as soon as he was willing simply to face it, he relaxed. And the tension which made the mistakes was removed. Willfulness does this time and time again. Willfulness creates its own obstacles. Willfulness forces the individual into an eternal defensive. He must constantly protect himself against something. And this exhausts him and opens him to countless errors because he no longer had the energy with which to organize his own thinking. He was confused by the pressure and the fight going on within himself. If we as students of philosophy are really trying to get something beneficial out of religion or psychology, as our interests may lie, there's nothing that would be more useful to us than the realization that there is no real ratio between will and result. That it is not that the will signifies the strength of the person. The will is not the thing by which achievement is attained or made inevitable. That which is the real source or mainspring of progress for ourselves, within ourselves, is this thing that psychology terms insight. It is becoming aware of where the values are. It is becoming aware of that which is next for us. And it is gradually developing the quiet resource to do that which is next, without fanfare and without tremendous dynamic. The individual does not need this will factor in the majority of instances. In rare cases, nature has provided the will to give us emergency strength or emergency force in the presence of obstacles. It has given us, as almost as it has given us courage, as a way of meeting a disaster or meeting an emergency. Will can get us across with a special burst of steam across some critic situation that arises. But will as a steady diet is a deadly loss. It is not a substitute for attainment in anything. Actually, will is in conflict and sets up conflict between man and the universe in which he lives. Self-will against universal will is a bad pattern. What we term progress today is this deadly struggle of man's eternal determination coming into conflict with natural law. Now, man may win to a degree, and he begins to think now a little more optimistically about conquering space and hopes that by means of the Einsteinian formula he will discover that he can outwit time and live long enough to get to another planet, star, or sun and come back. These things are fascinating theories, and they are intriguing. But the actual problem that man faces is not this at all. Here he is, heading out into space, and as one observer noted, with no certainty there'll be any Earth here when he gets back. The problem isn't whether he can get somewhere else. The question is, what will be happening here while he's gone? And this he doesn't get around to at all. It hasn't occurred to him that it would be very important for him to brighten the corner where he is now and get certain things done that desperately need doing. But with his eyes to the stars, like Thales of old, he is not watching his feet and is about to fall into another ditch. This business of always overleaping the immediate is a habit of man, but it's a poor habit that never pays off very well. Actually, our real problem is not this tremendous struggle to overwhelm and master space. if necessary, trying to violate its laws in order to get there. Our problem is to learn how these laws operate and move with them in every way possible. Another very simple example of this entire situation is the modern practice of therapy. Today, we are actually attempting, by means of various drugs, to impose man's remedies upon a universal pattern. We have decided that we are going to create health. The man is going to be healthy if we kill him, getting him that way. We are going to use one wonder drug on him after another until the internal part of his nature resembles an experimenting field at Armagado. We're going to set off one bomb inside of him after another. We're going to prove conclusively that the individual can make all the mistakes known in history and still feel good. That he can do as he pleases, and that we will outwit laws of cause and effect with a compound in which the small pellets dissolve slowly, giving us relief for several hours. We are going to do it our way. And we probably will live to see a great many people drop dead as a result of this. And we'll be fortunate if we do not live to see ourselves drop dead. Let us face it. Because we are going to do it our way. The way to health is not this way at all. The way to success is not over the bodies and minds and hearts of other people. The way to all things that are worthwhile in nature is a quiet way of acceptance and obedience. We don't need these things. We don't need these fantastic cures. They are for people who have willed themselves into a state of sickness by insisting on living contrary to the laws of nature. They are mostly persons who have allowed their own willpower to lead them from one absurdity of conduct to another. They have forced their own determination upon other people, have wrecked others' lives and then their own. And then in the midst of every neurotic situation you can think of, they are now determined to cure themselves with wonder drugs. And we are foolish enough, a great many people are foolish enough to think they can do it. Actually, the same is true of our minds, our natures, and our happiness. The beginning of success of a truly successful person is to be established firmly in those natural patterns which are suitable and proper to man. Without this establishment, he'll get nowhere and cannot survive. Then to discover what is proper for man to do. Now, it may well be that it's going to be proper for him to conquer space. We don't know this. But we don't know that it is. But we know that between his present state and the conquest of space is a vast area of self-conquest which he has never undertaken. So before we go out trying to change the face of the universe, it might be better to make sure that our own natures are adequate to our needs. There is no use extending our domain into space and doing to other planets what we are doing to other nations right here on this earth. Wherever we go, wherever civilization moves in, trouble comes with it. This is not what was intended, and this is not what should be. But it will be this way as long as everybody moves by impulse and nobody by common sense. Our common sense has the best chance to function when we are not kicking ourselves around or bossing other people to death. If we can relax and be fairly quiet and subdue these intensities by simply not stimulating them, we can perhaps get some thoughtful, reflective relationship with ourselves. if the average person could sit down quietly and experience communion with his own inner nature for 1.5 hour, it might change the course of his life. It certainly would help considerably. But driving on, always objectively, always on the outside, always neglecting the inside, the person simply has no reference frame, no security in time of trouble, and nowhere to go except in this strange, mad race to his own extinction. Buddha was of the simple opinion that you sometimes have to help nature in these kind of problems. So he created a set of obligations or rules which he imposed upon his monks and arhats. These rules were almost identical in every detail with the monastic rules of Europe. There was very, very little difference. But they were based on the simple process. If you want to find out what truth is, if you want to experience internal liberation from your own negative dispositional pressures, then you have to gradually remove the temptations from your life which make you a victim of selfishness. Therefore, Buddha pointed out the importance of the individual gradually relaxing away from the sense of possession. Not that he was to be beggared, not that he was to give up everything, but that he was no longer to think of things as belonging to him. Rather, to regard everything that exists in this world as belonging to itself, and that the best that we can possibly attain at any given time in our lives is a certain guardianship over natural things that were here before we came and will be here after we go. We can never own them. The only thing we can do is have a short lease on them. And our most important problem is to see that when we give them back to this stream of life to which they will always belong, that we give them back in as good condition as we got them in the first place, that we did not receive something beautiful and put it back broken and defaced. We cannot possess. All we can do is use. By what right do we then have temporary proprietorship? There is only one right recognized in nature, and that is the right of use. That individual is entitled to use that which he can use wisely. He is entitled to have at his disposal such resources as he can intelligently apply to the improvement of himself and others. Other resources do not belong to him. Anything that he wastes, anything that he squanders, anything that he uses for destructive purposes, he has no right of guardianship or even temporary possession. He proves his right to have by his ability to use. The individual has, therefore, in this world, nothing that he can call his own. He has nothing in this world that he can do that will actually solve the problem of his own existence. Whether he is a success or a failure, man is born, man suffers, and man dies. If we could break this tremendous exertion of will to achieve things which cannot be achieved, and are not valuable after they are attained, and get out of this desperate determination to conquer a world which must ultimately conquer us and swallow us into it again, we could relax. When we could relax, we could be good friends. We could be good parents. We can have beauty, music, art, literature. We can love poetry. We can take those walks along the side of the mountain. We can backpack into the hills if we want to. We can earn decent livings and good livings, but we can earn them quietly with a full realization that by this labor we are paying our own way in life, but that we are not here to gobble up. We are not here to dominate markets. We are not here to build corporation on corporation until the whole thing falls apart of its own weight. We are here to work together to build a world such as we would like to leave to our own children, a world of peace and quietude and brotherhood. We will not do this with mad expressions of willpower. Even if these willpower expressions are an over-resolute determination to have peace, even if we have to fight for it. This is the whole problem. We do not achieve peace by overwhelming or combating or fencing with the wills of other people. We achieve peace by quietly accomplishing those labors which we know to be best in our own small world, in the circle where we live. And we gain not only peace, but we gain better health, better enjoyment, freedom from the tremendous temptations which lead individuals into one dilemma after another, and such dilemmas as are now arising are enough to frighten the angels. We do not need these things. They are all sick, half-crazy people fighting desperately for something like status, struggling for a little of this more, a little of that more, ever willing to sacrifice life, character, integrity, value for this gratification of this determination to have what they want. Let's just relax the whole thing and realize that we do not know what we need. As Pythagoras is reported to have said, all men know what they want, but only the gods know what they need. If we are quiet and reasonable, perhaps the divine part of ourselves will tell us what we need. But sometime we must realize that there is a great difference between fulfilling a need and gratifying a desire. Fulfilling a need helps us to grow and be bigger people. The eternal gratification of desire is destroying us and tearing down our civilization. So we have to realize the need for the quietude, the peace, and the serenity of the untroubled life, the life that is free from unreasonable ambition, free from blind pressure of will, and free from man's constant and eternal determination to outwit his fellow man. We don't need these things. Without them, we're getting somewhere. With them, we're getting nowhere. So relax the will, take it easy, and just kind of float along on the surface of events, and we hope they will float you back here next Wednesday evening. Thank you very much.